Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals by Zoom. today we did have sort of a technical glitch with the timer. So the marshal will be showing you sort of the 15-minute countdown and the 5-minute countdown on his phone. So just sort of, and the marshal's on the screen. Before we get started and call the first case, I just want to remind people that this oral argument is being orally recorded, so it will be available, I think, within 24 hours. However, for all parties, you are not permitted to record it separately, either by video or, on a tape recorder. So just keep that in mind. With that, our first case this morning is A20-1321, Miller et al. Versus Public Storage. As I'm sure the parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, just tell us who you are in a loud voice, and you may begin. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Edward Rooney. I'm the attorney for the appellants William Miller and Penelope Eiselman. By way of reference, Penelope Eiselman is William Miller's mother. They're both appealing from summary judgments entered against them on their respective claims. Mr. Miller's claims for conversion and civil theft, Ms. Eiselman's claims for consumer fraud. I have, particularly in the appellant's reply brief, tried to brief these issues in this appeal as thoroughly as possible, with the exception of a case concerning consumer fraud that I will call to the court's attention later. But because of that, I would just, in this argument, like to address 5 main points that I think should be, the court should remain aware of, and of course, answer any questions that the court has. First of all, I'd like to address the standard of review. This is de novo review. So what the trial court did is of no concern to this court. We're not giving any deference to the trial court. What is concerning to this court from the trial court is simply the trial court record. Does the court record that this court will be reviewing ab initio compel the summary judgments that were issued? And I think if the court reviews the trial court record carefully, it will see that there is sufficient evidence in the record to prevent summary judgments on all of the respective claims. And I will start, first of all, with Mr. Miller's claim, which is conversion and civil theft. The elements of conversion, are an intentional.
Mr. Reed, before you get to that, I just want to make sure, are you, I don't know if I quite agree with the standard of review, but the key is, are you saying there are any material facts in dispute in this case?
Absolutely.
Okay, absolutely. Which ones? Which ones are in dispute?
Ownership and the justification for the, I think ownership is the main one on the conversion case, because Public Storage apparently says that my client, because he was a minor at the time, cannot have ownership of personal property. But we've got evidence in the record that he claimed ownership. His mother, Penelope Eiselman, claimed that he owned it. There's no evidence of anyone else claiming an ownership interest. So yes, there's on the conversion claim, ownership is the crucial one, because I don't think anymore Public Storage is trying to defend the...
Let's say, for the sake of argument, you're right, and the minor, or at the time, this was all his stuff. Is that really relevant under the terms of the agreement? Since, as I recall, the agreement was, if whoever signs the agreement, it's supposed to be their stuff, and if you want someone else's stuff, you're supposed to notify the respondent. So,
Judge, I'm so pleased you asked me that question, because that is a crucial question, and I think it's a crucial mistake that the court has to avoid making, because Public Storage relies...
Well, then we'll do our best not to make it.
Well, and let me explain how you can avoid making it. Minnesota, the terms of the agreement are irrelevant to the conversion claim and to the civil theft claim, and here's why. Because Minnesota law does not permit exculpatory language in a contract to defeat a claim for conversion. So anything that says Public Storage is not liable, or that Public Storage can limit its liability, cannot be enforced under Minnesota law. But more to the point with your question, there is nothing in the agreement that says that by storing property in the unit that belongs to someone of the occupant, that works a forfeiture of the true owner's property. The agreement says it cannot be done, but if it is done, that is a breach of contract. And it is not, there's nothing that would permit a forfeiture of ownership. And let me call what I think is the best example I can think of. Suppose my son rents an apartment that says no pets allowed. And suppose my wife and I are called out of home with our cat, who we can't leave alone because we have to go somewhere. And we ask our son, but please just take it for the weekend. Okay, son agrees. Now he's taken our cat. He is in breach of his lease. He has property there that shouldn't be there. Let's say the landlord discovers it. What is the landlord's remedy? The landlord's remedy is to terminate the lease if he chooses to evict the client if he chooses to. But what the landlord's remedy is not is to seize that cat and destroy it. And that is what public storage is claiming the right to do, even though its listing agreement, although it forbids that property.
Well, certainly I agree with you. And since my daughter has an apartment that forbids dogs and wants to get one, you know, this is certainly interesting to me. But, you know, does the analogy break down based on the terms of this agreement in terms of what happens when, you know, you don't pay your rental fees? And also, does the application of Minnesota law dealing with what can happen, you know, with the stuff that's stored? I mean, it seems to me that that's a little different because there's no law that says you can kill a cat, you know, if there's a cat on the premises in violation of the lease. Whereas here, I mean, isn't there, doesn't the statute kick in terms of what you can do with the property once it's been disposed of, or, you know, once the lease hasn't been paid?
Well, first of all, there has to be a default. And
Wasn't there one?
Absolutely, there wasn't one.
A monetary one.
Monetary default. There was no notice of the rent increase. And so there was no default because both the governing statute and the terms of the lease say we can only raise the rent after we've given notice. And so there was no default. I mean, I'm not saying there has to be a finding, but at least in terms of defeating a summary judgment, there are certainly material fact issues whether there was a default. But once again, the lease cannot work a forfeiture of ownership, and the Lien Act doesn't work a forfeiture of ownership. And this is my opportunity here to remind the court how powerful a tort conversion is. Innocent mistake is not a defense. A good faith is not a defense. To my mind, this is digressing a little bit, but I think it is important to recognize conversion is almost a relic from an earlier age when the focus of the law was protection of property rights. We've advanced, we look at a lot of other things now, dignitary rights, anti-discrimination, but conversion still is incredibly strict. And I've cited a couple of cases where there's innocent mistakes and it doesn't matter. There's an example from the restatement of torts that I cite in our brief where an auctioneer thinking property belongs to somebody and he can sell it, innocently thinking that, but it doesn't belong to that person, sells it, that auctioneer, notwithstanding his innocent mistake, is liable for conversion. There was a case from Jeshurun versus Kent, 1936, I say in the reply brief. Somebody stored a chiffonier, a locked dresser, paid rent to somebody to keep it stored, defaulted on the rent. The person who owned it, the landlord, unlawfully sold that, was liable for conversion. It turned out the chiffonier contained valuable items. And the landlord said, I didn't know about that. And the court said, well, if you'd gotten rid of it rightfully, that might have been a defense. But you got rid of it wrongfully, and that is no defense. So it is important to realize, and because public storage relies on this, it's the only defense it can raise, and it is a defense with no merit. The terms of the lease agreement can neither defeat a conversion claim, nor do they work a forfeiture. A complete stranger could have had things in that locker. And if public storage wrongfully sold the contents of that locker, which the court in the earlier case found as a matter of law that it did and from which public storage did not appeal, public storage is liable to anyone with an ownership interest of property in that locker if it wrongfully
sold. Well, Can I ask you this? Because, you're making a lot of arguments regarding tort, but there's a prior case involving Penelope in which this court has already ruled that this was a contractual matter, and that by the terms of the contract, she agreed that she wouldn't have other people storing their things in that locker. So, how can you ignore the case that's already been decided by this court?
I can't ignore it, Judge, but I can tell you the court why it doesn't bind in this case. First of all, of course, it's an unpublished case, so it's no precedent.
It's the law in this case.
It's the law in that case, but let me explain why it's not the law in this case. It would only be the law in this case if collateral estoppel or res judicata made it binding in this case. And we can look at each of the claims separately. It's not binding in William Miller's case because the reason the Court of Appeals said Penelope Eiselman had no conversion claim was it invoked what's called the independent duty rule. She had a contract with Public Storage, and because she had a contract, her only remedies were under breach of contract. Well, it's clear William Miller did not have a contract with Public Storage. And in fact, when William Miller tried to intervene in his mother's lawsuit back in the trial court denied him intervention and said, you don't have a contract. This is a contract case. You go ahead and bring your own remedies, claim your own remedy if you want to. There is nothing in this contract case that impedes your right to seek a remedy. So as far as William Miller is concerned, there is no collateral estoppel bar because he was not a party to the contract. Now, I happen to believe that the court's decision in that case, which we're stuck with, is wrong, but even so, it did not address the issue here.
If we take your arguments to the logical extension,
yes,
I mean, the terms of the contract limit is that they not only limit who can put property in this storage locker, but they also limit how much property you can put in there. And basically, if we adopt your reasoning, then why would anyone ever rent more than one storage locker? Because you could rent one locker, have all your friends just throw their stuff in there and have $1 million in the storage locker, which is clearly contrary to the contract.
It is. And frankly,
and so that any use of that storage locker, wouldn't it necessarily, because it has to be done with the consent of the owner of the storage locker, doesn't it?
No. But let me get back to the
contract. I mean, but how could you store property in someone's storage locker unless the person who is renting that storage locker gives you consent?
Oh, it's with the consent of the tenant. Absolutely. But you don't need, for conversion's sake, even if the owner never don't forget, the limitation on liability in that agreement is enforceable with respect to negligence. If there was a flood or something, or if the Public Storage had left the property unguarded, and if you could point that the loss was Public Storage's negligence, Public Storage would be completely entitled to enforce its limitation on liability. But Minnesota law does not allow it to do that with respect to the intentional tort of conversion. That is, and once again, Mr. Miller was told he couldn't be in that lawsuit because he didn't have a contract, but he could pursue his own remedies. And so the issues are not identical. And also, res judicata should not apply where it is not fair. And he was told to go make your own lawsuit, which he has done. And it has different issues. Likewise, and I'll just get to it because we're talking about res judicata and collateral estoppel. The trial court did not dismiss or grant summary judgment against Penelope Eiselman on the basis of collateral estoppel. And it shouldn't, because she never had a full and fair opportunity to litigate her consumer fraud claim in the early one. She was not allowed to bring it. So with that, in that respect, I'm sorry, Judge, I just disagree. William Miller had no contract. He cannot be defeated by contract defenses. Public Storage, in terms of Penelope Eiselman's, because I don't have much time. Likewise, Penelope Eisenman's consumer fraud claim is not barred by the statute of limitations because she suffered no financial loss until at the earliest February of 2014, which was within 6 years of when she made the counterclaim. So Minnesota law requires there be some loss. And in the reply brief, we talked about some loss has to be more than hypothetical. It has to be loss that would support a cause of action. Until the landlord wrongfully raised the rent without notice, Penelope Heiselman, notwithstanding all of the misrepresentations that were made to her, had suffered no loss. And so, and likewise, the other thing to remember is Penelope Heiselman is bringing the consumer fraud claim, not only on her own behalf, but on behalf of others who have done or are induced or inclined to do business with Public Storage. She's seeking injunctive relief for ongoing wrongs, ongoing deception by Public Storage. So there is no statute of limitations bar in that respect. But the crucial thing for the court, this listing agreement cannot create forfeitures of ownership, and it cannot defeat a intentional tort of conversion claim. And I think I've got 7 seconds left, which I won't try to fill up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rooney. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Now hear for counsel for the respondent, please. And if you could just first identify yourself for the record.
Yes, my name is Abraham Kaplan. I represent the respondent Public Storage in this lawsuit. Your Honors, Judge Houghton is exactly correct in this case. And appellant's counsel does misstate the record. There is clear collateral estoppel. And this Court of Appeals decision in the related Eiselman versus Public Storage lawsuit goes to the heart of the issue in this case. The appellant's counsel argued that Margaret Eiselman was barred under the independent duty rule. This is not the case. Penelope Eiselman tort claims were barred under the independent duty rule. Margaret Eiselman's claims were barred because the contract had clauses under 3B of the contract that did not allow a non-occupant to store property in the unit. And if a non-occupant stored property in the unit, there must be written notice to Public Storage. So that is precisely the reason why Margaret Eiselman's claims were rejected by the court and upheld by a court of appeals. And those claims are identical to William Miller's claims in this lawsuit. It's a third-party claim that there was no notice and there was no consent by Public Storage. Therefore, under the terms of the contract, the claims go away. Now, appellant's counsel brings up the concept of conversion as a strict liability tort. And he cites to the case of Jeshurun versus Kent, where someone had something stored in a storage locker and someone wrongfully sold it. And he was able to collect for it for the terms, even though he didn't know that it was in the storage locker. But the crucial difference in this case and that case is this case has a contract that specifically governs the third party property claims. In that case, it would be akin to a contract stating that no property could be stored inside the storage locker, because that's what we have in this case. No property belonging to William Miller was allowed to be stored in the storage unit. Therefore, Public Storage, when it enters into these agreements with consumers, in order to prevent the possibility of endless liability to every single person that stores property in the unit, they strictly limit it to occupant property up to $5,000. If we don't follow the terms of the contract, then it wouldn't be a low-cost storage.
Mr. Kaplan, how do you respond to at least part of Mr. Rooney's argument that, you know, the contract says that, but he's saying that someone at your client's company said, yeah, don't, here I'm paraphrasing, you know, don't worry about that. You know, you can store your kids or your grandmothers or whatever. How do you respond to that argument?
So under clause 16 of the contract.
So you're relying on the integration slash merger clause, right?
Well, not integration slash merger. It specifically requires any amendment to the lease to be written. And that oral conversations between a low-level Public Storage employee with a consumer is not going to modify the terms of the contract.
But those provisions don't apply if for fraud, right?
Well,
I mean, if the client said, or if you're, you know, someone at your client said, oh, don't worry, you know, there's actually, it's not a $5,000 limitation, it's $1 million. And you know, there's a claim for fraud related to that. Those clauses don't bar fraud, correct? I mean, I think that's what the law says.
So
I'm not
so,
saying this is fraud. I'm just saying there is an exception for those. There's an exception for those clauses under the law.
So even if there is an exception for those clauses, the ISIM and trial court reviewed every single allegation between the conduct between Penelope ISIM and Public Storage and ruled that there was no fraud already, and ruled that it was not reason, even if true, which it didn't even rule it's true, but even if true, no reasonable consumer can expect that a contract is amended between a conversation with a low-level employee. So these issues are coming up for the second time to the Court of Appeals. And this court has already ruled in the Eisenman appeal with Margaret Eisenman's claims that those conversations between Public Storage and Penelope Eisenman did not allow Margaret Eisenman to store her property in the unit. And these are identical claims. So there is no fraud, and the contract clearly requires non-waiver of Public Storage rights and a written amendment to the party's lease agreement. And on top of that, no reasonable consumer can expect a low-level Public Storage employee to have agency to modify the terms of a contract. Public Storage is a multi-billion dollar company. It enters into very strict lease agreements. You can't have Public Storage employees willy-nilly modifying the terms of the party's contract and alleged utterances between the consumer. Now,
what's your response to the consumer fraud claim? I mean, are you saying that, I mean, I have the briefs in front of me, but, you know, what are you saying that those commercials aren't fraud, period? Because, you know, whatever they are, but no one's saying, oh, by the way, you can store your grandmother's furniture no matter what the contract says. What's your argument to defeat the consumer fraud claim, Mr. Kapp?
So we are arguing that facially, as a matter of law, the three Public Storage TV commercials as described by the consumer are not fraud. The consumer references the first two commercials reference someone storing a kid's property in the unit. There's a box labeled kids toys or somebody storing a crib. Now, clearly, parents have property that they identify with their kids. If a parent gives their kid an Xbox for Christmas, they're not saying that we're giving a complete disposition of the Xbox to the child and it now belongs to him. But rather, the child can hold it. But ultimately, if the parent wants to take it away and ground the kid, the parent retains ownership. So no reasonable consumer can look at the Public Storage commercial, see the word kid, and say, oh, my extended family is allowed to store their property in the unit. So that's number one. But number two, under the trial court's reasoning, this is clearly barred by the statute of limitations.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Kaplan. You know, a lot of parents, you know, their kids move around a lot and they bought a lot of stuff in the dorms. And, you know, most of us would just assume not have all that stuff in our garages. So very often, you know, they'll rent a storage space for, you know, and assume now these are adults, they're over 18. And they're, you know, it's their stuff. I mean, it was their desk, it was their, you know, futon, it was their bed frame. But, you know, I'm storing it, but, you know, I'm signing the agreement. I mean, and I'm paying it. It's not my stuff. Are you saying because it's my kid's stuff under those circumstances, you know, I have to tell your client that, okay, it's not my stuff, it's my kid's stuff. All right. Is that, am I correct? That's what you would require?
Absolutely.
Because how often do you think that happens?
I don't know.
In the real world, I mean, I know we're in appellate land, but how often do you think that really happens?
Well, again, I would point out to the court two things. Number one, we're not dealing with a college age kid in this case storing his property. It was a minor. So, although I'll address your honor's question, this case is not where the you have a 21-year-old that had a bed that belonged to him.
No, I get it. Right. I'm giving you my example, which is my college graduate daughter, all of her stuff, I don't want it in my house. I want it in, I'm going to get a storage unit. I'm going to put it all in there. I'm going to pay for it. So I just want to make it clear, under the terms of your agreements, if I don't tell you, hey, by the way, those are all my kids, my adult daughter's futon, then I violated the agreement and you can toss all of her stuff out the door if I don't pay the lease?
Well, again, so in order to limit liability for low-cost storage, public storage cannot be facing double claims of action because that would necessarily increase the cost of the storage. So in that case, the college-age adult, you're correct, would need to enter into the agreement herself. As Judge Houghton pointed out, these units are very big. And if everyone in an extended family above...
So just that I'm clear, let's say there's no question, I've paid the lease every month. I've paid it every month. So I'm not in default. And for whatever reason, you know, I didn't tell you it was my kid's stuff. And for whatever reason, you tossed it. Are you saying I have no remedy and my daughter has no remedy against you?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Because who would have the remedy then? Could I then see you saying, hey, you stole the kid, you know, where's all the stuff?
Because in that case, the exculpation clause would not include an intentional tort. So if an employee went in and peeked through the window and said, hey, we have non-occupant property in here, let's go get it, that's an intentional tort. And that person can sue for conversion. That's what appellant's counsel misstates in this case. This case is a case where the Isom and trial court ruled that it was negligence that caused the removal of the property. That there was a notice that was sent to an outdated address and not an updated address. A case of negligence versus intentional torts under the law is radically different. Under the Supreme Court in Schlobaum versus Spa Petit, which is the seminal Minnesota case on this issue, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled that a party can exculpate themselves from negligence, but not intentional torts. Now, appellant counsel repeatedly argues in his brief that because Public Storage intentionally auctioned off the property, this was an intentional tort. But under the case facts of Schlobaum versus Spa Petit, this is not true. In that case, a therapist or a weight trainer went over to someone and intentionally recommended the person go from 20 weights to 40 weights. And the person ultimately got injured. Now, that case, there was an intentional telling them to go to 20 to 40, as in this case, there was an intentional auction. But the reason for it was negligence, that an outdated address was used instead of a current one. So in a case where there's any maliciousness, any intentional conduct, the parties would have a claim of right to sue for conversion. But this, under the doctrines of collateral estoppel, we know it not to be the case. This is a case of pure negligence, nothing more.
So counsel, let me back up just a second. It sounds to me like you are addressing the argument that appellant made about the Eiselman determination that Public Storage did fail to send the lien notice to PI's last known address. Is that right?
Correct.
And that was not challenged on appeal. That's final. I mean, I'm recognizing it's an unpublished case, but it's still collateral estoppel in this case, right?
Correct.
Okay, so explain to me why there isn't a question of fact about default.
So again, the trial court ruled that Public Storage made an error under the statutory notice that it was required to send. But that ruling only applies to Penelope Eiselman. A third party cannot have a claim for that, for the lack of statutory notice.
Right. I understand there's no claim under the statute for the notice. That part I'm good on. But if I understand Mr. Rooney's argument, I could be wrong. He is suggesting that public storage's right to sell the goods to clear out the unit turns on the contract, right? That's why you're claiming you have no liability to Mr. Miller, because you didn't know that his goods were in there. But if you didn't have a right to sell it because Penelope wasn't in default, then where does that leave us? I mean, it's similar to what Judge Connolly's hypothetical is. It's just a little different. You know, what if there is no default? Are you then able to sell those goods without any recourse? In this case, by Mr. Miller, not a signer to the document.
Absolutely, Your Honor, it's a valid question. I think the most important distinction is that what Your Honors are concerned about is that if someone intentionally or maliciously goes in and converts the property, that there would be no recourse. And under the law of Minnesota, there would be a recourse.
You're relying strictly on your exculpation provision, the hold harmless agreement. Is that at the bottom of this argument is basically that Penelope signed her name to a document that said she would hold harmless the public storage. And that's why public storage isn't liable to Mr. Miller.
No.
No. Okay. See, reason, I don't understand. So give it one more try.
That's okay. So the reason why public storage is not liable to Mr. Miller is because once somebody puts their property into a place that's governed by a contract, they are governed by the terms of the contract. And the contract relating to Mr. Miller says third parties cannot bring suits of negligence against public storage. Again, so public storage is facing a situation where it has a big unit. And if the court rules that anybody can put their property and sue for conversion, you can have a single auction that 30 people sue public storage for conversion for, each claiming they had a $5,000 trinket in the unit. That radically alters the terms of the negotiated agreement between Iceman and public storage, because public storage is facing limitless liability in that case. So in order to take that away, they enter into a contract saying any party that stores their property in the unit and that property is destroyed or removed due to negligence, they have no claim. So the concept of conversion being a strict liability tort, it can't be in this case, because there's a contract that says if you put the items in the unit, you lose the claim.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Your time has expired. Mr. Rooney, we'll let you have the last word, sir.
Thank you. And I apologize for speaking fast, but I have a lot to say. First of all, conversion. If Penelope Iselman had permitted people, 100 people, to put items worth $10,000 in that unit, and public storage sold that unit without lawful justification, it would be liable to each of those rightful owners for conversion. You cannot contract your way out of liability for conversion. Conversion does not require malice. Mistake is no excuse for conversion. So there's that. With respect to res judicata, Penelope Iselman's claim was denied by this court, her conversion claim, because it was found she did not have permission to have her property there. However, in this lawsuit, public storage has said William Miller did have permission to have it there. It said that in its memo to the trial court in support of its motion for summary judgment. It says, and this is document number 97, trial court, page 25, public storage does not dispute that parents can store minor children's property in a storage unit. Boom, the permission issue is taken away. Public storage repeats that in its brief to this court at page 48.
Public storage, with all respect, I think there's like, I think, you know, there's a second sentence to that, which is, except, you know, you got to give notice, you know. I mean, how do you respond?
They didn't say that to the trial court. May be that the contract says that, but they don't say notice is required.
Well, I mean, how would you respond, though? I mean, I have some I share Mr. Kaplan's concerns. I mean, if there wasn't some limitation, how would you know if 20 different people are each storing, you know, the Hope Diamond in this, you know, storage facility, which, you know, I can't remember what the charge was, but, you know, I thought it was only like, you know, $15 a month or something like that. And then, you know, the agreement sort of says, well, here's the limitations, here's what you have to do. And, you know, then all of a sudden these 15 Hope Diamonds are gone. I mean, are you saying that each of those people would be liable for conversion, or excuse me, would have a claim for conversion against the storage company?
Unless Minnesota changes its law of conversion, yes. How can public storage avoid that liability? Don't intentionally take property you have no right to take, because conversion is that strict liability. I just want to address a couple of more things. There's a case that I should cite to the court. It's called Minnesota Supreme Court Wigand versus Walzer Automotive Group, and it particularly addresses the contract and how it relates to consumer fraud. Because in that case, the court said, we conclude that the existence of a written contract that contradicts the plaintiff's alleged or the defendant's alleged oral misrepresentations does not, as a matter of law, negate any possibility that the plaintiff and others could potentially prove a causal nexus between the oral misrepresentation.
What was the oral misrepresentation in this case?
Two of them. First of all, your mother can put your mother's contents of her whole house, store it up to the rafters. Now that from consumer fraud, that says permission to store your mother's. And it also says fill a place to the rafters with the contents of a house, which certainly can reasonably be thought to probably exceed $5,000. That's one of the oral misrepresentations. Another oral misrepresentation was when the public storage manager, and I will call the council talks about low-level employees. Every public storage employee is held out to the public as a manager. And if you can't rely on what a manager of a business tells you, we are in trouble.
But what were the misrepresentations in the commercials?
The commercials, they were not explicit misrepresentations, but they misrepresented the idea that you can sell and store members of a family, even adult members of a family's goods. They showed a lot of valuable goods being stored.
Well, I mean, you can, as long as you let them know what's going on.
They didn't say that. And we have record testimony.
No, but they did not say that either.
Okay, but we have, in terms of defeating summary judgment.
I don't think these commercials said anything, as best as I understand.
Right, and commercials rarely do. I mean, beer commercials don't say you'll get all the good-looking young women you want, but they are sending a message.
So if I don't get a good-looking woman by drinking Miller Lite, well, not that I would since I'm married.
Well, that's tough, but
I can sue them? I have to admit, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, I don't see how those commercials, as you represent them, have any fraud whatsoever in them. But,
well,
you
know, then overlook the commercials if you.
I will let you have a little extra time since I gave Mr. Kaplan a little extra time.
Thank you. The other thing I have to say is this family paid the rent every month. They were permitted by the manager, store your mother's contents in there, it's fine. Now they've lost their multi-generational treasures. And they have no remedy. That can't be right.
Could I ask you this though? Because I know that you're making an argument with regard to the representations that were made by the agent. But how do we interpret that in light of paragraph 16 of the agreement, which says these agents aren't authorized to say anything unless you get something in writing from our management. To amend the contract, it's unenforceable. I mean, it's actually in that contract.
It is, Your Honor. And I'm sorry.
So I mean, I keep hearing your arguments, which are basically ignore what's in the contract. It doesn't matter. And I mean, how do you get around that? I guess is
you got around that by looking at Minnesota law, which says a contract, written provisions, can be modified by the behavior of the parties, even if the contract says that they cannot. And that, I apologize, I did not brief that thoroughly in this one. It's briefed thoroughly in the Eisman versus Public Storage briefs because it is established Minnesota law. Parties, by their behavior, can modify the written terms of a contract, even if the contract says they cannot be modified. And just the other thing is, I'm not saying the contract doesn't apply to negligence situations. Contract cannot apply to defeat conversion. So I very much appreciate the court's time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kaplan. Thank you very much, Mr. Rooney. We appreciate the thoughtfulness of your arguments. The matter is submitted and we will issue our decision within 90 days.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.